Good morning.
Good morning.
I see you're all nice and cheerful today. Excellent. So today we're going to begin with the topic of simulations. And so basically we're going to look at three techniques for analyzing network performance. The first is queuing theory. So Connor McArdle has been moving you through that a bit, and we'll continue to do so. And queuing theory is an analytical technique, and it's great, and it has some very powerful results, but you do have to make a number of assumptions in order to get these results. So one question becomes, what happens if those assumptions are not terribly realistic? And so a second technique that we'll discuss in this module is simulations. And simulations use fairly similar mathematical models to represent the systems, but instead of trying to get some sort of closed form answer, what we do instead is try and generate possible behavior for the system. Okay, and so you can't do this exhaustively, but what we'll look at is how you can get sort of sufficient amount of representative behavior to be able to draw conclusions about a system through simulation. And then finally, we'll look at other sort of mathematical techniques, which can't be binned into queuing theory, but are applied to networks in various places. So, the references for today's topic are, well, first and foremost, Harry Parros, Computer Simulation Techniques, The Definitive Introduction. And this is available free for download as a PDF file. And we'll be covering a significant subset of what appears in this document. Okay. If you are interested in looking into it in greater depth, or you know you don't like the sort of degree of explanations found in the Harry Parros document, Jerry Banks et al. Gives quite a good, discussion of the types of simulations that we'll be doing. There's a number of editions of this, and sort of mathematically, nothing much changes. He rolls over examples to be more topical. Okay, so what we're going to look at today is basically, well, what is a simulation, and how do we handle some of the basic components, or how do we sort of build some of the basic components of a simulation? Next week's lecture then will be how do we draw mathematical conclusions from these sorts of models. So we'll start with a brief motivation. And again, typically if somebody's asked, you know, what does an engineer do? Well, they problem solve or they design systems. Okay. And so what any sort of performance analysis is getting at is how do you properly design a system? How do you build something that's fairly complex and have some assurance that what you're doing is a good idea.
Okay.
So we're going to start with just a very quick look, definition of a system, and then look at a fairly generic design procedure for a system. And again, we'll comment then on where it might be, performance analysis might come in useful. Okay. So our working definition of a system is a group of interacting, interrelated, or interdependent elements forming a complex whole. Okay. Now, typically engineers view these components as doing something, and specifically as sort of existing in an environment, taking input and producing output. Okay. And typically, the types of systems that become interesting are, again, complex systems where you don't want to sort of just have one solid block, but you want to think then about subcomponents that can be designed relatively easily and interact with each other to get the job done. Okay. And so usually the goal is to get the job done correctly. So given an input, you want to get the right output. And then on top of that, we also have this idea of performance, which at the first cut we can say is just given an input, you want to produce the output in a timely fashion, or you only want so many errors or some additional constraints on the system. Okay. So just taking a look at a generic design procedure, the bottom line usually is that the more planning you do, planning and testing you do in advance of actually building a system, the more likely it is that the system will behave correctly in the end. So a number of steps have been identified, which again can help with this procedure. And so the first thing you're going to want to do is to just define exactly what it is your system should do. So this is a system's requirement specification. So you need to define what's your input, what's your output, and specifically the output should be defined in terms of the basic functionality of the system and the performance requirements. Okay. So if you don't pin down exactly what your system should do to begin with, then you're likely to be in trouble. Okay. And so the question arises, well, are we doing this right? And what information can we get? And so one thing we could ask is the specification complete and consistent? And so complete means basically that for every input we've defined an output, and we've defined all of the outputs that we need. So whatever the system can possibly do, we've written it down, and we haven't left anything undefined, unless it's sort of just irrelevant. Okay. Now, again, for a complex system, you get The question of then, is this specification consistent? Which means, have you written down two things which are directly contradictory to each other? Okay. And so typically, there are ways of addressing sort of the quality of specifications, but typically you would probably wouldn't be doing any sort of simulation at this point. The next step then is to begin to plan out your system. And so you want to define the basic building blocks and their interactions with each other. So, you know, if you're designing, you know, the Amazon website, you know you have to have a user interface, you know you need shopping carts, you know you need databases, you know you need certain components. And so you can specify what those components are and, again, how do they feed into each other? Obviously, for instance, a shopping cart accesses a number of databases. Okay. So for each of these basic building blocks, you're going to specify the input, the output, and the basic architecture, so how they interact with each other. And so the questions you ask are, will the blocks work together to produce correct output or performance? And what performance parameters will basic components need to deliver on overall system performance requirement? Okay. Now at this point, you might actually think about some sort of analysis to address the problem, whether this is simulation or mathematical analysis, because again, we've got some functionality and then we have the idea that we have some performance requirements. Okay. So moving on from that, you will want then to produce detailed design of the different components. And when you have a detailed design of the components, you can begin to examine the components themselves to make sure that they're behaving the way that you expect them to and have the performance characteristics that you expect them to. So again, if you have a design of a system, you can think about modeling it and asking these questions through a model. Then at this stage, you will probably attempt to build the system. And test the system. And finally, deploy and maintain the system. Okay. And frequently part of deployment and maintenance is adaptation of the system sort of as time goes on and requirements change. Okay. So, one rule of thumb for this design is that the earlier in the procedure that you discover errors in thinking, then the less expensive it is to rectify those errors. And so typically, again, you want to start looking at the performance of a system before you necessarily even have the system built. Okay, so you want to be assured that the way you think you're going to build it is actually going to work. And so, obviously, before you have built the final system, in order to answer those questions, well, you could try building a simple prototype, or you could try a mathematical model for the system. Okay, and again, simulation would be one of those key mathematical models that you can use, even if you know a physical system doesn't exist. Following on from that, even after the system exists, simulation can play a role in asking questions about the system. Specifically, if the environment changes, so for instance, the load on the network changes, we can use simulation to examine how that's going to affect the system. And also, if we need to change or adapt the system, we can use simulation to sort of perform scenarios, so to see how specific adaptations will affect the performance of the system. And again, if you have a system that's up and running, you can't just adapt it and see what happens, so you have to find some other way of addressing these questions. Okay, so what are we specifically interested in? Well, specifically, we're going to be looking at the performance of networks. And we've said that there's a number, besides just sort of getting a packet there or not, there's a number of parameters that are significant for networks having to do with the time it takes to get packets through the network. Okay. And so the networks are going to be concerned with their own performance. How many packets can they get through? How many packets do they lose? How good a use are they making of their resources? So are they, you know, do they have too many resources, too few resources, etc.? And users also are concerned with the characteristics of the networks because they, as they impact on their applications. Okay. Now, the thing about networks is that they represent quite complex systems. They're a combination of hardware and software, and again, fairly complex software. We went through the basic OSI architecture. So, examining these can be quite difficult. Again, we'll look at specifically mathematical analysis techniques. They usually require you to make some very specific assumptions about how your network is set up. The nice thing about simulation techniques is that you can relax those assumptions and you can build in sort of whatever degree of complexity you want. Okay, so it's merely a matter of what features of the network do you want to represent. And if you get if you take a look at sort of commercial or popular network simulators, you will see that they are quite detailed and can be quite complex. So you'll probably run into NS2 sometime in your career here. That's an open source simulator, and it models all sorts of networks and network components. OpNet would be one of the popular commercial offerings. And again, they offer quite detailed models of various components of networks. Okay. Now, what we're going to look at here is going to be quite a bit more basic, because I'm going to be asking you to build your own simulation model. And the reason for doing this, again, is to gain an appreciation of what are the components that go into a simulation model, what is the fundamental mathematical principle behind these models. Okay, so if you use NS2, you'll probably just plug something in, you get an answer out. And what I'd like you to have sort of coming away from this is an appreciation of where those answers came from. Okay. So, again, we will look at analysis, specifically queuing theory. Some other analytical solutions. When they apply, they're great because you get an answer out. One answer. Simulations allow you to develop more complex models than you pretty much can with analysis. It's still just a model, so you're still just taking components of a system or characteristics of a system. You don't have the actual system, so there's always going to be some question about how close your model is to the actual system. But you can build up much more complex representations of systems. The trade-off, again, is that what a simulation model does is it generates a single stream of possible behavior for the system. And so what we need to do is to ensure that that behavior is in some way representative of the system overall. Okay. So I've been talking about simulations and simulation models. And just saying that basically they're a way of asking questions about a system and that they somehow generate behavior for a system. Just to pull out some formal definitions, and these both come from Banks. A simulation is an imitation of the operation of a real-world process or system over time. And then a simulation model is a set of assumptions concerning the operation of the system. Okay, so a model is just some way of trying to represent the system behavior. Okay, these assumptions can be expressed in mathematical, logical, or symbolic relationships over various components in the system. Again, we're concerned with pretty much mathematical representations. And the purpose of the model, then, is to allow the observation and analysis of system behavior. So, two words have crept into our discussion of simulation. Those are discrete event and skip forward one then. So what is a discrete event simulation? Well, discrete events or events refer to how we view system behavior. Okay. And if you've ever taken a control theory class, for instance, you think of systems as evolving smoothly over time. A car driving down the road, it's sort of It proceeds incrementally. Okay. With discrete events, we view the system as changing abruptly. Okay. So things happen pretty much instantaneously that cause the system to be qualitatively different than it was before. So one easy thing to think of here is a light switch clicking on and off. You turn the light on, off, the lights go off and the room goes dark. So you have two states, bright and dark, and those states, you move between those states at sort of discrete instances in time. Okay. Contrast that with a dimmer switch or something where the lights might gracefully go off. Okay. So I'll move back just not to neglect this slide. We've touched on this before. Simulation is one method that you can use to draw conclusions about system performance. The alternative methods available would be prototyping. So actually building a simple version of the system, and arguably a lot of times simulations can be less expensive. Also, arguably, not always. So one thing you would want to do in choosing your testing method is to determine sort of what's the least cost method you can use. And then, again, analysis is also available. Again, there might be a trade-off between cost and realism, or perhaps not. Perhaps your mathematical model fits the bill, in which case most likely it's going to be cheaper than simulation. So again, you need to sort of choose what testing method you use carefully. Okay, so back to our discrete event simulations. We have a system whose state is changing sort of abruptly at certain points in time. Frequently, we don't know exactly when this is going to occur. You can't predict exactly when I'm going to switch the lights out. If you guys start falling asleep, I might flick them up and down. Try and wake you up. So, you don't necessarily know the times of occurrence may or may not even be important. Again, for the systems we're looking at, network systems where the whole bottom line is about time, then the time of events, the time that events occur is going to be very important. Okay. If we don't have if the times are not fixed, then we're going to have some probabilistic distribution to describe the time of occurrence of the events. Okay, and this is where things start looking more like queuing. Okay. So we have this system where we say that the state is changing at these discrete points in time. And so the behavior of the system can be represented as the sequence of events that are occurring, and we'd sometimes refer to this as a trace. So, our events, our discrete events, which we'll call events, denote the change in the state of the system. And so, a sequence of these events is going to denote the evolution of state in the system. These events may have timestamps, which are labels indicating their time of occurrence. Okay. And so here we have our example of the light being switched on and off. And so the two states of the system are light off and light on, and the events are the light is either switched on or the light is switched off. Okay. And you can see that you're going to cycle between switching a light on and off. Okay. If it's of interest, we can keep track, again, of the time at which these events occur. So in this case, we'll have our behavior is light switched on at some time, T0, that switched off at some time, T1, that switched on at some time, T2, etc. Okay. And so the question that would remain would be just what are those times, T0, T1, T2, and how do we arrive at them? So taking a second example, which is sort of, again, closer to what we see in networks, we'll look at a queue. So a queue is just that. It's a queue. People, entities, jobs arrive, and then they also leave at some point. Okay. Now, at a first pass, the simplest representation of the state of this queue is just the number of entities in the queue. Okay, so we have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 entities in a queue. What this doesn't do is give you the ordering of arrival if the entities are in any way sort of distinct. So we could think of more complex queues where, say, it's people, then Jane arrives before Tom arrives before Jim is different than Jim arrives before Jane arrives before Tom. But in either case, you're going to have a relatively simple representation of state, which is based on the arrival of people or entities into the queue. Okay. So the next question is timing. What do we know? And I believe you should have already seen, again, in terms of timing, what we usually specify is the inter-arrival time, and specifically this is governed by some sort of probabilistic distribution. And then we assume that things are arriving to receive service, and so there is a service time, again given by some sort of probabilistic distribution. Okay. And so, again, the behavior of the system is going to be some sequence of arrivals and departures, and based on the arrival times and the service times, we can pin down times of those arrivals and departures. Okay. So, again, these sorts of simulations can be used to study the things that we've already said. Simulations can be used to study. So, alternative design choices. We can compare two different designs based on the same input. Or, again, impact of changes in input on existing systems. Okay, and so these are all sort of networky examples. So what sort of local area network should I deploy? A token ring or an Ethernet? Where should I put a new base station in a cellular network? What is the reaction of a network to an increase in demand? If you have a call center, when should you add a new worker? Okay, so what hopefully you can do after at the end of the module is at least look back on these and sort of imagine how such a simulation model would be built. So, we're going to take a look at a fairly simple example of a simulation model. The first thing to note about this model is that we can actually write it down by hand. Okay. As we build up the complexity of the models, and we can generate the behavior by hand. As we build up the complexity of the models, that becomes less and less useful. But what we'll see as we go through this example is the components that you typically need for a simulation model. Okay. So, the example is the machine repair problem, and we have a collection of machines which occasionally break down, and when they break down, they need to be repaired. There's one repairman to repair the machines. The repairman will repair the machines on a first-come, first-served basis. Okay. So, we might want to know something about the performance of the system. What percentage of time is a machine broken down? And that's going to be a function of time between breakdowns and the speed with which the repairs can be carried out. And for what percentage of time is the repairman busy? Okay, so again, if you think of packets instead, this is what the packet sees, and this is the efficiency of your node. Okay. So, the question we're looking at here is how do we represent this as a discrete event simulation? And so we're going to need to define the basic elements of the model, and that is first and foremost the state of the system and the events which are leading to change of state. And so the state of the system is going to be the status of the machines. And the considerations that we might need to make then are, do we need to distinguish between individual machines? Is it sufficient to just sort of look at generic machines, or is each one, or Do we want to know something about specific ones? And following on from that, is it enough to know the sort of general state of the queue, sort of the number in the queue, or do we need to know the ordering of the machines within the queue? Okay. And the events, well, what can happen in the system? Machines can break down and machines can be repaired. Okay. And how do the events change the state of the system? Well, a machine breakdown increases the number of machines to be repaired, so it changes the queue. A machine being repaired decreases the number of machines to be repaired, so it decreases the number in the queue. Okay. What else is important? Well, we have to have rules. We have to say, how do the events impact, change the states? Okay. So here we have, well, arrivals and departures at the repair shop sort of, again, change the number of machines in the repair shop. And again, this is going to depend on service and a number of elements depending on exactly what information you want out of your model. Okay. What else is important? Time is important. Again, the simulations we're going to consider, the critical piece of information that we need is at what time are events occurring. Okay. And so we've already, the time elements for our simple example are when do machines break down and how long do they take to fix. The question that we need to ask ourselves is how do we represent that time within our model? And typically we use clocks to keep track of the time of occurrence of specific events. And then we may have a master clock, which will keep track of the overall progression of time. And finally, we have to have some sort of initial condition, so we need to know the state of the system when we start off. So, sort of pinning things down, we can assume we have, we'll take for our model that we have three machines. Each breaks down after every 10 hours of use, and each takes 5 hours to repair. That doesn't seem too good. Well, that means that every machine's going to wait a fair while. But what we've done here is we're not dealing then with probabilistic distributions on the time. We have a deterministic distribution on the time. Again, that's just to make the example a bit simpler. We're going to use four clocks. Three event clocks indicate when the breakdown occurs for each of the three machines, and then the master clock tracks the overall passage of time. The state of the system is the state of the machines. Are they broken down or operational? And the repair queue, which machines are awaiting repair. Okay. So again, for this simple example, we can just sort of write it out by hand. We need to start with some initial condition. And so in the initial condition, what we set out is when each of the machines is going to break down. Okay. So what we see is that we can have three possible future events corresponding to each of the machines being repaired. Then, three possible events corresponding to each of the machines breaking down. There cannot be a repair event because none of them at the moment are broken down. If we ask the question, which machine is going to, or which event is going to occur first? Well, we can examine our clocks, and we see that the first breakdown will be of machine one. Okay. So this occurs at the overall time one. And it leads to one further event that now it's possible for a machine to be repaired. Okay. In terms of state, we can see that there's one machine waiting for repair. That machine is machine one, and it means that our repairman is now busy. Moving on, again, just examining, we see our next event would be the breakdown of machine two. It doesn't lead to, the way we've set this up, it doesn't lead to any further events. But we have two machines waiting, and we can specify the order in which they're waiting and that the repairman is busy. Moving on, the next event to occur would be that a machine is repaired. And this machine would be M1. Since there's more than one machine waiting for repair, this causes another event to appear, the repair of the second machine. And this will happen, assuming that our repairman isn't taking any breaks, it'll happen 5 hours after the first one. Okay. And so, moving on, the next event to occur is that machine three breaks down. So again, we'll have two machines waiting for repair. We can track what machines they are, and that the system is busy if that's significant. The next event will be that the machine is repaired. And that's, I'm sorry, I should have said earlier, when the machine got repaired, that led to the next breakdown of the machine being scheduled. You see that here. The machine is repaired, leads to machine two repaired, leads to the scheduling of the next breakdown event for machine two. It also leads to the scheduling of the next repair event, since there is somebody waiting for repair. And so finally, we get to a point where it's possible that two different things could happen. In a real system, typically you just sort of flip a coin to decide which one happens, or else you would have to add additional rules to say one should take precedence over the other. Okay, the master clock is just keeping track of the overall time as it progresses through the system. Okay, so these clocks are sort of coming and going. And the master clock is again.
I can see the rest of the query here, but I just can't see where the figures 1, 4, 6 from the master clock corresponds to the rest of the simulation.
Okay.
I just can't see where the actual figure 1, 4.
Okay. Well, that is essentially what you're doing is you're hopping from event to event. And so this just gives you the overall sequence, the overall times of all the events. Okay. And so the first event happens at time 1, the second event happens at time 4,
third that happens at home, sixth. So it's just keeping track of the overall time coverage throughout the system. And the main purpose of that is so you can generate next events. Typically, you need to know what time you're at when you're generating future events. So that's just a way to keep track of that. Okay, so what we can see from this is that we have, or we can extract our traces, so we know which event occurred at which time, which we give our traces. We also have complete information about the state of the system, and we have information about the timing of the system. Okay. So another further thing to note is that the exact behavior exhibited by the system was dependent on the initial conditions. Okay. So I picked the initial order in which the machines would break down, and that impacted on the trace from then on. So that means that we're going to have an infinite number of possible behaviors to be observed. And so again, we're going to need to somehow be able to say when we can relate what we observe in a single trace or what we observe in a number of traces to some sort of typical representative behavior for the system. And that'll be the topic of next week's lecture. Okay. In terms of the representation, if we had assumed that the time to repair was, or the arrival times were random, then the occurrences of the events could not have been predicted as they were. Again, as I went on, every time a machine was repaired, I just scheduled a breakdown for that machine 10 hours later. It might possibly be that, typically a machine's not going to be that predictable in terms of when it breaks down. So possibly you would have to define some distribution for that breakdown time. Okay. Then what would you be doing if you run a simulation? Well, you'd have to pick one time somehow, again, based on that distribution. So randomly pick a time based on that distribution. Okay. And so, again, we have the idea that you can get an infinite number of behaviors just by changing your initial conditions. You're also going to get an infinite number of behaviors because there's no predictability in the time. So what we're going to do today is examine how we would build these systems, but next Friday, we'll look at, again, how do we look at a finite number of these behaviors and make some overall conclusions. Okay, so we've pretty much seen the basic components that we have for our simulation model. We have the events, we have the states, we have the time, and we have some rule that tells us how we sort of evolve with time. What we're going to do for the rest of this lecture is sort of discuss how this maps into components that you can write yourself to produce a simulation model, and a few details on how sort of specific components might be produced. Okay. So, we have been looking at a very specific sort of system that can be represented, again, using what we call discrete events. And basically, what we have is we built up a list of possible next events, and we looked at which one of those is actually going to occur next. So we looked at all the actual times of those events, which one's going to occur next, and then, assuming that occurred, we looked at, well, what happens in the system? How does the state change? And have we generated any more possible next events? Okay. So, when you're building your simulation models, the events are going to be key to your representation. And what we'll do is we're going to maintain a list of possible future events. Okay. We need some way of keeping track of time. Again, that usually is a combination of a master clock to keep track of how much time is elapsing overall in the system, and then event clocks to track what happens with specific events. The state of the system is changed by the events, but future events are also dependent on what the current state of the system is. And so you will need then finally to relate the state and the events via some set of rules. Okay, and that's the state and the rules represent the event, what we call the event logic. Okay. So the job of the simulator is going to be to examine events as they occur and to determine how those events change the state of the system. And again, typically what we actually track is, or what we need to track then, is what possible future events can be caused by the occurrence of our current event. Okay. Just for completeness, I'll mention that there are three possible different, slightly different representations for discrete event simulation models. There is what's called an event advance model, a unit time advance model, and an activity-based model. Okay. The one that we're going to use and look at is the advanced model. I believe if you take Martin Collier's module, you'll probably also do a time advance as well. Okay. So in an event advanced model, the simulator will produce a time-ordered list of future events. The master clock's time advances from event occurrence to event occurrence. So it doesn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If the first event happens at 2, that's the time that the master clock is advanced to. If the next event happens at 7, that's the next time the master clock is advanced to. Okay. Every time an event occurs, then the future event list is updated, the current event must be removed, and new events are scheduled as a consequence of the event occurrence. Okay. So that's exactly what we did in the example we just had. You don't have to do it that way. It suits if, the time between events is fairly random. A second method is what's called unit time advance. And in unit time advance, the master clock is what's driving the time. And so it advances a unit at a time. And then the event clocks are compared with the master clock value. And if the value is equal, then the event occurs and appropriate action is taken. Okay. So if you had, in this, you would be going 1, 2, 3, 4. And in our example, the first event occurred at 4, I believe. Let me just check that. Yep, first event occurred at 1. The second event, then the master clock would move on 2, 3. The second event would occur at 4. Okay. So if events sort of happen fairly regularly, that it can be as useful a way to proceed as any other. Okay. The final method, which again, I'm mentioning these for the purpose of completeness, focuses on activities as opposed to events. And again, events are things that occur abruptly in time. Activities have duration. Okay. And so what the simulator does is it describes the conditions by which an activity will either start, by which the activity starts and then later stops. Okay. And so essentially what you're doing is then you're getting sort of you're describing periods between pairs of events, essentially. Okay, so we can see how this works for a single server queue. So for the queue, what we've been thinking of is sequences of arrivals and departures. Well, really, all those arrivals and departures are related to jobs being done. So we can think of the activities related to those jobs. So you have an inter-arriving activity, so the time between jobs, you have a waiting activity, the time that a job will wait in a queue, and you have a service activity, so the time that a job is served. Okay. And again, these activities are interrelated. The end of the inter-arriving activity begins, is the start of the waiting activity. The end of the waiting activity, it becomes the start of the being served activity. Okay. So, you can express, and you can express the relationship between these activities in a similar way that you would express just the relationship between events. Okay, so it's another way of representing things. Again, we're going to focus on an event advance model. Okay, so what are the major components of this event-based simulation model? The events with their associated clock and the system state. Okay, and to represent the evolution of the system, we're going to produce an event list which timestamps future events, is a list of timestamped future events ordered according to the time of occurrence. So you want to be able to figure out which one happens in which order. So order the list. And then you have event logic, which describes what happens to the system when an event occurs. And so the state might change and new events might be scheduled. Okay. And finally, you need a time advance mechanism for handling clock activities. Your output, again, is a sequence of time-stamped events as they occur. Okay, so we have this future event list. So we examine the list and find the first event on the list to occur. If it's ordered, well, that'll just be the top of the list. We advance time according to the timestamp of that event. And then, this covers a multitude of sins, we take appropriate action depending on the type of event. So we decide how the event, the occurrence of that event impacts on our event list, essentially. And so we need to know, did the occurrence of this event cause the potential of any new events to occur in the future? And if so, we create those new events, and we add them to the appropriate spot in the list according to their timestamps. Okay, so that's how things work, basically. I'm going to take a break here. When we return, we'll look at a couple of sort of, we'll look at details of a couple of these sections. Specifically, we'll talk a bit about building event lists. Again, we're going to suggest for your assignment that you use some sort of linked list. If you do it in Java, then there's a library and it's not that tough at all. And we're also going to look a bit at the generation of time, and specifically if time is random, how do you generate these sort of random samples, random points of time. So we'll do that. We'll take about a 15-minute break, and then we'll return to that after that.